So, James Thompson, you've had a long, storied career in the Apple development community. When did that start? I'm like mid-90s?
Early 90s. I mean, the first Mac I ever used was in 1990. But I mean, I kind of really started, my computing started with like the Commodore 64 in the sort of early 80s, like around 83, 84, something like that. And it was about then that I did my first programming, on a BBC Micro Model B. Which all the schools had. And that was my first sort of, very basic in both senses of the word programming.
That's
and
great.
then, sorry, go
Sorry,
on.
just 2 seconds. You're one of the first people to ever mention like one of the Euro computers, for lack of a better term. Everybody here in North America kind of came up on the Apple II with a Commodore or that kind of thing. But there was a whole bunch of interesting computers over in the UK and in Europe that were unique. Like you had a computer from the BBC, for crying out loud. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, it was there was also, I mean, the main sort of schoolyard rivalry was between the Commodore 64 and the Sinclair Spectrum. And I chose the Commodore 64 purely because it had a better version of Pac-Man on it.
And why?
But it also had good graphics and sound hardware and much better games than the Spectrum, and I'm sure you'll get letters already. But then around that, there was all sorts of other strange computers, and the BBC at our school, I think we were one of the first schools in Scotland to get a computer, and this would probably be about around 83. And the teachers went around the classroom and they said, we've got this thing called a computer. Does anybody know what it is? And there were four people in the school that had a computer, and I was one of them. And we got basically made into the guardians of this BBC Model B. And this was in primary seven. So this is the seventh year of school. So I'd have been about, I don't know, 11 or 12 or something. And we ended up having our own office. And we sort of sat in there for most of that year, just messing around with the computer and not actually doing a hell of a lot of work. And we would teach the teachers how to use it. And we would also teach classes before the start of normal school, where we would have the younger kids in and we would do sort of computer class with them. And that was my sort of first experience of it. And, that's when I started programming. The BBC had a very good basic that it was well known for, and you could do sort of things like graphics and sound and so on with it. And one of the things I remember from that time, which was actually the first program I ever worked on, was all the schools in our area were invited to part of a competition to submit a multimedia pack based on The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and which school won would get the glory. And so, you had the primary one and two kids drawing things, and you had people writing essays, and this pack was put together. And we decided what we would do is we would write a text adventure with a few graphics based on The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And it was really basic stuff, the sort of Infocom, I mean, and not even at Infocom level, but, just sort of go north, that sort of thing. And we wrote this thing and we were really pleased with it. And the pack got submitted, and our school won. And we thought, well, clearly this is because of our fabulous, software. And the guy who was the head of the libraries came up to us afterwards and he was saying, "Yeah, I really enjoyed the pack. It was great." But there was this cassette in there and I put it inside my stereo and I played it and it was all just these high-pitched whining noises. So yeah, that was my first sort of app review experience.
Yeah, shipping software is never easy.
Yeah.
Especially when you actually have to put it in the mail.
But from that point, I used like a variety of computers. My next door neighbor, he had an Apple II, and that was really my first Apple experience, except it was, you know, just playing Lode Runner and various games on it. And I think it was about late 80s, I got an Atari STE, which I bought purely because it had MIDI sockets on the side, and I was very into my synthesizers at that point. And you could also get a not strictly legal copy of the Cubase sequencer software from the local market for a pound. Mm-hmm. And so I would spend endless hours messing around with that. But what happened was, in the first year of my computing science degree at Glasgow University, I came across the, I think it was Mac Pluses they had at that point. And I just sort of used this thing, and I it was clear that the Atari had just been like a cheap copy of the Mac. And I'd never used the original, so I didn't know what it was like. And then I sort of sat down and thought, well, this thing is just brilliant. And it all just seems so well designed, and the user interface and stuff. So I sold all my synthesizers and my Atari, and I bought an original Mac Classic with, I think, upgraded to 4 megabytes of RAM and a 40 meg hard disk. And wow. that's where I started programming.
It's a big move, getting rid of all your synthesizers.
Yeah, I know. The music career was, it was a great loss to everyone, I would say.
But, yeah, you could have been a rock and roller.
I think I was actually terrible. I mean, I still have the zebra striped and pointy Thunderbolt guitar that is in my parents' attic.
Oh, man. I thought you were going to say slacks.
No. But I was very much in a sort of...
I kind of want to see that now. We got to get a picture of you with that thing.
There are some pictures. I don't think they'll make the show notes, but I'll see what I can do. it was just because, you know, I enjoyed messing around with sequencer software since the Commodore 64 days. And I wasn't particularly good at it, but I could produce something approximating music. I just wasn't particularly good at playing any of the instruments.
Yeah. There's a similarity between sort of figuring out musical stuff and code and math.
Yeah, I would agree.
There's a lot of patterns, and you can, if you're an intuitive pattern person, you can kind of noodle through it a bit.
I think I'm probably better at programming than I am at music, though.
Yeah. So you get the Mac. The Mac didn't have BASIC and didn't have a native programming thing that bundled with it.
No.
So was that a setback for you? I mean, were you aware of that before you bought it, or were you just like, oh, I'll figure it out?
No, the reason that I bought it was primarily because at our university, we were using Macs. So for all my programming exercises, we were using initially Turbo Pascal, the Borland one, and then Think Pascal. And so we were doing lots of stuff in Think Pascal anyway. So it made sense. And we were allowed to, under the educational license, to take copies home. So we were, you know, I used that for doing my coursework at home. So one of the times when we were doing stuff, we'd normally done just sort of text-based processing. So, you know, read in a file and spit out another file. But one of the things we started doing was using basic quick draw drawing. And so as part of that, they had to give us the full Mac libraries to link against for our project. And I realized at that point that gave me access to not just QuickDraw, but the entire Mac APIs. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I could write a program. And one of the things that I'd really, my favorite subject at university had been user interface design. And we had done a project which was to design the perfect central heating remote control unit on a wall. and we'd done it in HyperCard. So, you know, it was a perfectly good system for prototyping user interfaces. And I had drawn all these little fake 7-segment LCD digits and these little buttons, which I'd used for this central heating control thing. And I was trying to decide what I would do to learn how to program the Mac. And I just went out and I bought Inside Macintosh 1, 2, and 3, and I think 6. And because System 7 was just about to come out or had just come out. And I thought, well, I shall learn this. And I thought, well, I think the calculator that comes with the Mac is pretty rubbish. And it would be useful if I had something that did, you know, hex and binary, because I'm actually using that in bits of my course. So I shall write my own calculator. And because I had these fake 7-segment LCD digits and the buttons, I thought, well, I'll just reuse those as well. And I wrote pcalc, the first version. And it was written in Pascal. And I started just doing it for my own use. And then I started passing it around people in my class. And they encouraged me that I should probably, you know, ship it to the rest of the world. And in December 1992, I did. And I submitted it to the Infomac archives. I still have the original email.
What was it like?
The Infomac or
the original pcalc?
The original pcalc, it's much the same as it is today, really.
I love that.
I can show you screenshots of it. It was originally done on the screen of the Mac Classic I had, which was 512 by 342 1-bit monochrome. So, you know, it was designed initially in monochrome, and then I had a sort of grayscale with a few color highlights added on it, but it wasn't something that I could see on my own screen. So I needed to test that on other machines. And in fact, version 1.0 that shipped didn't actually work on a real color screen. You just got complete garble if you tried it on a grayscale screen or anything. So
you're saying the new hardware dilemma has haunted you since the beginning?
Yes. Yes. I didn't have access to the hardware. So you just, try it in the simulator and ship it and see what happens. it was based on, I had this old Casio calculator, which I'd used in school, and it did some basic hexadecimal and binary stuff, and it had some conversions and things. So it wasn't exactly designed to look like that, but it a lot of the functions came from that. And I didn't know what some of the things were, and I kind of reverse engineered how stuff worked and just added it gradually to pcalc. And this was at a point, it should be mentioned, that was, you know, pre-web. So this was 1992. So we had like FTP sites and Usenet and like, so it was interesting just sort of throwing it out into the void and then, you know, starting to hear back from people who liked it. And then it built up from there.
It wasn't originally a product, right? It was more, it was back in the days where you just kind of share your software and see what happens.
Yeah. I mean, it was free. And I said, send me a postcard. Mm-hmm. And I got lots of postcards from around the world. And,
when those great days, that's great. Sending a postcard is like, so it's just warm.
And, you know, that continued on for a couple of years. And then in 94, I started working on DragThing, which was my application doc, sort of inspired by the NextStep doc. Because I'd seen Next machines at the university as well. And there were a couple of other things on the Mac at the time. And there was a thing called Applicon, which became the Tilery by Rick Holzgraf. And that was the main thing that I used as an application switcher on the Mac back then. But it didn't support drag and drop because drag and drop was only just about to exist.
Yeah, System 7, right? Exactly.
Yeah, it was 7.5 that drag and drop was appearing. But if you had 7.1, you could install like a drag and drop manager and stuff and develop on that. So that was my next project, was to write what I basically an application switcher, but also to start to learn System 7.5 APIs. And that started out with the same thing of, well, just send me a postcard. It's totally free. And then I changed it after a while and I said, well, send me something cool, because some people had sent me other things like t-shirts or whatever. And the send me something cool was interesting because I started getting really weird things. Like somebody sent me an original animation cell of the Pink Panther from the titles of the Inspector Clouseau movies.
Holy cow, that's awesome.
And, you know, and somebody sent me like Pixar stuff, and, you know, like, you're starting to get like really cool things. And one day, somebody contacted me and they said, they worked for an advertising agency, I think that represented Coca-Cola or somebody. It was a fairly big agency. And they said, well, our accounting department doesn't understand the concept of cool. Could we just send you money instead? And it was like to show how naive I was at the time that this had never even occurred to me, you know, that people would send money. And I said, yeah, sure, money's good. And they were like, well, you know, what were you thinking? And, you know, we want, you know, let's say it was 200 copies or something like that. And I think I named some figure, assuming that that would be the total amount. And they sent me that multiplied by 100. And it was like, you know, finally the penny dropped and I realized that I could actually make money from doing this. And at that point, I think what had happened was, at this point, I had left university, but I hadn't actually left university because, I had applied for a job, and this sounds strange, but Tetra Pak, who are the people who made like cartons for orange juice and things, I think they were Swedish, maybe, they had a base in the UK. And they were one of the biggest employers of Mac programmers. And for some reason, they ran their factory production floor using Macs, which was madness. But, so I had applied to them for a job, along with a friend of mine, Dare. And Dare was about a week ahead of me in the interview process. And we both had the first interview, which went fine. And then he had the second interview. And between his second interview and him getting offered a job and my second interview, the company discovered that it had no money whatsoever and wasn't going to be employing anybody. So Dare, because he signed a contract, got a payout and I got nothing. And I wasn't bitter at all, but, at university, I had sort of got in with the systems team, like the IT guys who like looked after the labs and things, because we had these year reps for each year. And, you know, we would go and make our case to the higher ups of what the students wanted. So I was a student representative. So I was a known troublemaker, basically. And I had spent, you know, 4 years complaining about the state of the Mac servers and the labs and, you know, why couldn't we have this software? Why can't we have this, you know, store of public domain software? Why can't we do this? So basically my punishment for this was to be given a job to work and look after the Mac labs and look after the servers and then have students come up to me and say, why can't we have this? Why can't we have this? So I was working.
Sweet revenge.
Yeah. Yes, I was working at that point at the university and writing sort of bits and bobs of Mac software. And one of the things in the documentation for Drag Thing was there was a line in it because the you know, you would include like all the stuff in the README file. And there was a line in it that basically said, I always wanted to work for Apple. And many, many years later, the line in the documentation changed to be careful what you wish for.
Yeah. I mean, how sincere were you? I mean,
totally sincere. Okay. I mean, I hadn't really, the first company that I actually applied to was Sega. because I was a massive Sonic the Hedgehog fan and I really wanted to work on this. And it didn't really occur to me that this stuff was not being written in the UK. So I got a rejection letter from Sega and I wrote to Apple as my second choice. And I got a rejection letter from Apple Den in Stockley Park because they weren't employing programmers in the UK. But I got an email from somebody in Cork in Ireland saying that, you know, we have a small development group and I saw your stuff and I've seen your software. Would you like to work for Apple? And I said yes. So at that point, I quit my job and moved over to Ireland with my wife, and I started working for Apple then.
Was that a tough decision to make? Oops.
Not really. I mean, I was pretty young at the time. I'm trying to think. I would have been 23. So, you know, it was an opportunity. And I don't think it really, I mean, I'd spent my formative years with the Mac up to that point, you know, sort of reading through, the typical thing was reading through the credits in the Finder. You know, if you did the About the Finder, you'd get the scrolling list of credits that went all the way back to sort of, you know, pre-Macintosh days. And, you know, I'd always read that and just thought, I really want to be part of that list. And it was a great opportunity. So, you know, I went for it. So it was interesting because Cork was mostly a manufacturing base. I think they'd started out making Apple II era things, and it was pretty much, you know, sand went in one end and circuit boards and computers came out the other end. It was a full, you know, they did all the circuit boards and up. It wasn't just an assembly plant at that point. But by the time I got there, there was a fairly small group, a software engineering group, and they were working on, when I got there, they were working on a lot of Copeland stuff, like original Mac OS 8. And there was a hardware team that had done things like, there was a TV tuner card for the performers that was done in Cork. And it was just little stuff like, I think, control panels that not sort of high profile, but important things.
Yeah.
And so I started there, and the first thing I worked on for 2 weeks was the installer for Copeland.
Oops.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? That's probably the bit that got used the most. So good for you.
Well, the installer did actually get recycled. At least the UI did, into the installer for the other Mac OS 8. But it was an interesting time because I realized that as I joined, it was like Apple was on this downward freefall. And my manager resigned after a couple of months. And, you know, I think it was...
This is what, like 95 kind of thing?
No, this was 96. So I started 96, just about, I think about 96. And I think by 97, Apple had posted a $1 billion loss for the whole year. And it was clear that bad things were happening. And, Copeland had been officially canceled and people were still working on it. There was a sort of, you know, refusal to accept the fact that it had been canceled. And, you know, clearly they're not crazy enough to actually cancel it. So we'll just keep working on it in case they change their minds.
Oops.
And
dysfunctional. Yeah.
There was that whole, it was just a strange time to be there because, at that point there was much talk that, you know, Apple was going to buy B, and use BIOS as the fundamentals of the next Mac OS system. And obviously that didn't happen. But at the time, so when I started, I was kind of not really aware of this, and layoffs started happening and people started, you know, if somebody left, they didn't get replaced, and the group was gradually shrinking and shrinking, but it was happening so slowly that, you weren't really aware of it in terms of the greater company politics. And we were just this little island from the main mothership. But as time went on and I got to work on more high profile stuff and got to go over to Cupertino, it was quite clear what was happening. But initially when I started, the first real project that I worked on was, print studios for Disney. So the kind of things where you would you could print out a greeting card or a calendar or a height chart or something on your printer. And the way that had happened was, Apple had gone to Disney and said, you know, we've got these new former consumer computers coming out and we would like you to write versions of your Windows print studios for the Mac. So we've got some software to include with them. And we'll pay you, let's say it was, you know, $1 million to port the stuff over. And Disney turned around to Apple in Cork and said, we'd really like you to port these print studios over and we'll pay you like $500,000 to do it. And Cork said, yeah, sure, we'll do that. So the first one we did was 101 Dalmatians. And we got the Windows source code and a printer, and we were able to write it. And there was, I think, four engineers, and I wasn't one of the senior ones. There was a sort of one senior guy and a couple of others. And we worked on this and we wrote it using, PowerPlant, Metworks, Code Warrior, which is what I use for pretty much everything I did at Apple. And it was in C++.
Yeah, that was used. The PowerPlant sort of subsumed the toolbox in a lot of ways, but it gave it like a more object-oriented veneer.
Yeah, and there was a constructor, which was a bit like Interface Builder of its day. And so we wrote that, and we didn't use any of the Windows source code at all, and we just re-implemented it. And I did a lot of the graphical stuff, like writing custom UI things, like little scroll bars that had Dalmatians on them instead of just being
yeah.
And that was actually one of the most fun projects I worked on when I was at Apple, because we had no deadlines, no pressure, no sort of oversight from Cupertino on it. We were just sort of writing it, and we took the time we took to make it. And it was a lot of fun, and I hid lots of little Easter eggs in there, even though there was a contract that explicitly said that these products were to have no Easter eggs. So that just motivated us to put in as many Easter eggs as we possibly do. And, you know, nothing bad, but there were just little tiny things that I put in. And it was, if you saved the project file with a certain name and reloaded it, it put in a picture of the development team, stuff like that.
That's just a bug, James.
Yeah. I've no idea how that encrypted copy of that photo got included in the source book. And I worked on that. And then immediately after that, and when we wrote it, we said, now this is only ever going to ship in Europe, isn't it? We're not going to have to do anything for, you know, US stuff or localization or
take all the names out.
Well, any double byte languages or anything like that. And they said, of course not. You know, this will be perfectly fine. So the next thing we worked on was a Hercules version of it. And they turned around and they said, oh, now we need to do all the US sizes as well. So we did that.
Wonderful.
And after doing all this stuff and working with Disney was a delight, as you can imagine. Because they had very fixed idea of what they called the assets, which was like all the pictures of Dalmatians or Hercules or whatever. And they all had to be perfect and they had to be exactly the right colors on every printer. And we would just get these notes saying, you know, oh, well, something about the assets and, you know, we need to tweak this and we need to tweak that.
Color fidelity on printers in those days.
Yeah.
Not easy to achieve.
And all the graphics we got were in some Windows image format.
Yeah.
So we had to write tools to convert those over and convert them to QuickDraw Picts. And we discovered in the in the process of doing that, we would create these PICT files that had zero sized elements in them, which would cause certain models of HP printer to crash and all sorts of things like that.
Man.
And after all that, I swore I would never write another piece of software that printed, and I've stuck to that to this day. But I was kind of, I didn't want to be doing print studios all my life. And, I kept talking to my management and saying, you know, I really want to work on, you know, something in the system. And, you know, we were hearing about, you know, Steve had come back and the next guys had come in and had taken over all the management positions. And we were still fairly well insulated from that, but we had seen, Copeland go away, and now we had, Rhapsody and then macOS 10 starting up. But at the Rhapsody point, when it was more just sort of a server OS, I got a job working on a network authentication server for that. And it was, I don't know if you remember Atties, which was a sort of, it was a simplified interface. Like, you got a basic finder thing, and it also, it was an access control thing. So it was useful for labs and kids and
things. I never used it, but yeah, it's ringing a bell now. I mean, it's a pretty specific use case, right? Like, you need. I mean, you need to have like a network max deployed, really.
Well, I think so. One of the things that they were going to use for I can't remember if they were calling it macOS 10 server at that point, but it was the server product. There was this hardware thing that we had heard of, this hardware project, and it was Columbus was the main name, and all the products were named after Columbus's ships. So Santa Maria, and I can't remember the others. This is terrible on Thanksgiving that I can't actually remember any
none,
of them.
None of us are American, so.
And so I worked on this Atties authentication thing, and it was fairly simple stuff. And I'd never written any networking code really before, because I was always a user interface guy, and that was where my interest was. But, you know, a job was a job. And so I spent quite a bit of time going over to the States and meeting up with the Atties team and working with them. And I could work on it remotely from Cork, and well, it was no problem. And there was one of the times that I was over, and we were all told, you have to go to the Flint Center. And we're like, okay, what's happening at the Flint Center? Oh, there's going to be an announcement. So we went to the Flint Center. And Steve stood up on stage, and he introduced the iMac, and said, "And it's going to be shipping in 90 days." And we looked at each other, and we said, "Do you think that's our project?" And as it turned out, it was. Columbus was the iMac, and at some point, it was going to be a diskless workstation, and there was going to be, you know, boot off a network and things like that. And so we had this, we went to this thing, and we had just been given a deadline for the end of our project. And that was quite a shock, I think, to many of the people in the room. But I did discover the other day, I still have a sealed t-shirt that we were given as we came out of the iMac Flint Center event. And I want to see the Steve Jobs movie purely so if I can see myself sitting at the back of the audience.
And who's playing you?
Yeah. Hopefully not Seth Rogen. But I think it was, I can't remember exactly the order of events, but I got approached while I was on this team. And I think this would have been 98. And I was sort of called to the States and said that there was a project that they had in mind specifically for me. And I thought, sounds interesting. And it turned out it was the Finder. But it wasn't just the Finder. So I was taken away to a small room, and I was shown a prototype of the macOS 10 dock. And I was told that only six people in the company had seen this because Apple was at the point of their immense secrecy at that point. And
as opposed to today, where it's like, hey,
yeah,
it's only epic secrecy today. It's not immense anymore.
Yeah. Well, I think this was the start of it. You know, we started seeing security doors going in everywhere and bits would get locked off. And but it was interesting because at that point, the actual internal network security was terrible. And you could basically sudo into any other user. And I remember demonstrating to, I think it was Bertrand or somebody, that you could, you know, SU to being one of the people who are working on all the secret stuff and just look at it.
Don't do that.
Yeah. It was like, I think the ethos amongst the next people had just been everything was open. And Apple had been a lot more locked down even then, before that point. But anyway, so I was shown the doc and I was told six people had seen it. And if anything leaked, they would know it was me. You know, my family would be targeted. And so I was given the design document for the doc, and it was, you know, said that it was going to be based on, you know, ideas from the OpenStep doc, but also mentioned drag thing, like specifically was mentioned in the design documents for the doc, which is, I think, why they had me in mind. Mm-hmm. Although it was interesting because everybody who was working on an application switcher at that time seemed to be working for Apple. I mean, there was lots of them. I'm trying to think of others at the time, but I think, anyway, suffice to say.
Yeah. I'm drawing a blank too, but yeah, like they, well, it makes sense because there's a lot of talent there, right? You touch the system, you touch the UI.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot involved in doing a good app switcher.
And, I had, interestingly, when I joined Apple, one of the, things that I said was I wanted the ability to still work on pcalc and drag thing in my spare time and that to be mine. And I got that written into my contract when I first joined. And you definitely wouldn't get that kind of thing at Apple today. You know, every waking thought belongs to the company. So I had been working away on drag thing in parallel, it had become shareware in July 97. And interestingly, at that point, the income that I was getting from drag thing was exceeding the income I was getting from Apple. But we'll come back to that.
Ouch.
And, you know, that was the good old shareware days where you could sell a product for $25 or $29 and people bought it and were happy about it. And anyway, so I started working on the doc, and there were fairly frequent trips over, and I would spend, you know, a couple of months out in Cupertino, living out of places like the Cupertino Inn across the road from.
Yeah.
And it was an interesting experience because now I was working on something that was, it was totally secret. And I couldn't even tell my boss in Ireland what I was working on. Which it was fun because we had to do all these weekly status reports and fill them in. And I just would put, you know, have been working on secret project, will be working on secret project. And after a couple of those, they just stopped asking me for them.
Was that difficult? I mean, was he, did he care? Or was he just
No.
Because it's weird that you're reporting to him still when he came.
Yeah, it was a weird situation because I had two masters. I had basically the Cork hierarchy, and then I was also working for a group within Cupertino. So I had two managers, and it's like a dog with two masters.
Right.
But so I was working away on that, and I was working away from Cork, and it was going reasonably well, and it was interesting because we were writing the Finder then, and I did some other Finder stuff as well, like the initial like contextual menu stuff I had done, and just silly little things like the info bar at the bottom of the Finder window. I had, you know, that says how many megabytes free on your disk. I had done that at the time, and So we were writing it again in PowerPlant and C++, and we were like the supposed to be the lead Carbon app for the system to sort of show that Carbon was a true peer of Cocoa at the time. And well, we know how that turned out, but it was interesting because the doc at that point was part of the Finder process. And, so if the Finder wedged, the doc would wedge and things like that. And there, there were some problems, but we were getting there. And, what happened at some point was, and this is a story that I've told a number of times. I know Rene's heard the story. So I was over in Cupertino, and there was going to be a demo to Steve or something. And Steve was talking to the designer of the doc because I didn't do the UI design of it. I was just implementing what the HI team had come up with. And Steve was talking to the designer and he said, you know, oh, how are things going? And this was a young guy at the time who, I mean, I was only 20 something, but, you know, he, I don't think this guy really understood Steve in the big picture. And so Steve said, how's it going? And he said, oh, well, you know, it's fine. The engineer, is over from Ireland. And, you know, we're making great progress on the dock and doing stuff. And Steve goes, interesting, and sort of walks away. And I've had the next scene retold to me by people who were in the room. But cut to Bertrand's office, Bertrand Serlet, who was the head of the Mac OS X project at the time, and my boss's boss's boss. So Steve comes in flanked with, I think it was Avi. And effectively backs Bertrand up against the wall and repeats the line, which I've said many a time, which I'm afraid you're going to get an explicit tag for. And he says, it has come to my attention that the engineer working on the dock is in fucking Ireland, and proceeds to swear at him for another 10 minutes or so. And the first I know of this is I get, a call from my direct manager in Cupertino, from the Finder team. And he says, you're going to have to move over to, Cupertino. And I'm like, and I think there wasn't an explicit or else, but at yeah, that point, implicit, it was a, right? There was an implicit. And I didn't want to, you know, live in the Bay Area. I'd spent enough time there. And, you know, while there is much to like about the Bay Area, it's not somewhere I wanted to live.
The weather was way too good.
Yeah, there wasn't enough rain. And so I wanted to stay in Europe. And I had, you know, great dilemma. Do I move or not? And sort of had looked into it. And there were lots of complications. And you know, I could get a visa, but my wife couldn't get a visa, so she wouldn't be able to work and things. And so I came back to them and I said, no, I don't want to move to the States. And they went away and thought about it, and they came back and they said, well, okay, we're just going to pretend to Steve that you have. So I had an office on the Finder team corridor. And, you know, it was like some kind of French farce that, you know, people would say, oh, have you seen James? No, you just missed him. And then I would be on a plane, you know, with less than 24 hours notice. I got so many air miles at the time when I was working for Apple that I had at least one, free trip for, to Japan out of it in terms of air miles.
Well, that's nice. From Ireland, that's not sneezing either. That's a yeah. Long way. Yeah.
And so, you know, I was just like back and forward all the time. And it was a pretty stressful time. And we were trying to get ready for it was Macworld in January 2000, which was when Aqua was going to be unveiled to everybody. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, it was great to see everything that we'd been working on up on the stage and Steve giving a live demo of the doc that I had written. And it shipped, I think, around the same time as part of developer preview one of macOS 10.
It's DP3.
Was it DP3? You're right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just to tell.
No,
let me tell you how it is, James.
Well, I can never forget the John Siracusa review of the doc from DP3.
Yes.
But so everything was revealed, and finally I could tell everybody what I was working on, you know, like including my own manager in Ireland. And it was like, great, you know, now all the secrets are out there. So it doesn't matter where I am and everything will be good. And then I get another call, and I think it was on my birthday, and it was my manager again saying, you need to move over to California or else. And there was an explicit or else this time. It was, or else we're going to take you off the doc and the Finder team, and we can't guarantee you any interesting work ever again. And that was pretty shocking. And basically I resigned. And it was, and as soon as I resigned, and I felt that all the stress of the last, I think I'd worked on the doc for about 18 months at that point, I felt all the stress lift off my shoulders. I knew I'd made exactly the right decision. But it was really hard because, you know, you're working for Apple, and I was in the position where I'd wanted to be. But what had happened over the years that I'd been there, and I was there about 4 years in Cork, was the development team had been slowly getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And as Apple was losing money, they were pulling lots of resources back to Cupertino. And I should have been paying slightly more attention to this. And about a month or something after I resigned, they fired the entire remaining development team in Cork. So it was clear that what they were trying to do was to say, you know, come over to California because we're about to fire everybody. But, you know, they hadn't really, I think, considered the possibility that I would say no.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was a sort of...
They're not used to hearing no, right?
Well, it's not that they couldn't understand why people wouldn't want to live in the States.
Mm.
And
yeah.
That was just a particular perspective of you know, the management then at the time. And so, yeah, if I'd waited another month, I could have got probably a nice severance package. But as it was, I resigned. And my version of the doc shipped in the developer preview 3, and Syracuse absolutely savaged it, saying that it wasn't fit for purpose in any way. And then they threw away everything that I'd written, because the guy who came in after me, he had a different idea on how things were going to go. And so all my code was thrown away. And it was all rewritten from scratch. And the doc moved out to be a separate process. It wasn't part of the Finder anymore. And yeah, it was basically 18 months of my life. I mean, probably longer, because I don't know that the authentication stuff that I worked on ever shipped either. so I spent about over 2 years working at Apple on projects that never actually shipped. The one thing that I worked on that actually shipped, and I got my name in the about box, was for a weekend's worth of work. And it was Sherlock 2, if you remember the little search engine thing. So I was over in Cupertino at working late on a Friday or something. And I was the only person in the corridor at the time. And my boss's boss came up and he was like, there was a keynote on the Monday. I think it was a Macworld keynote where they were going to show macOS 9 for the first time. And they said, Steve has said that unless Sherlock 2 is brushed metal, he's not going to show it. And I don't know, okay. And they're like, you know Power Plant, don't you? Yeah. Well, here's the source code to the QuickTime player, which at the time was the only brushed metal. And here's the source code to Sherlock. You have 48 hours. So I worked a very long day and night, and I got Sherlock running pretty much with the brushed metal look. I had to basically write a custom WDEF, I think, at the time.
Yeah, I was going to say, back in those days, it wasn't as simple as, like, you know, like on a Cocoa window, you can just color to a pattern image.
And, you know, the stuff in the QuickTime player wasn't designed to be ripped out and shoved into another app. And I did that, and it was shown as part of the macOS 9 keynote. And because of that 1 week, and basically because I had stepped up, I got my name in the about box for Sherlock 2. And I was going to have my name in the Finder about box, which was the one place that I, you know, always wanted to see my name.
Right.
And the other thing that I wrote for the Finder was I wrote the secret about box for the macOS 10 Finder, which had the scrolling list of credits going back all the way. And obviously I added my own name to it and the name of everybody else on the team, of course. And I think I checked it in, and a week later, Steve demanded that all credits be removed from all operating systems. I think there was some concern that people were being poached by other companies or something like that, or it was that not everybody was getting the credit, so, you know, just a couple of engineers shouldn't get credit. So my code got checked in, and the secret about box was changed to do the "here's to the crazy ones," text from the thing, yeah, different adverts. And I don't know if that shipped, but that was what the secret about box said for a long time. And it was just because we had switched in the text of that to switched out the credits at the last minute. So yeah, I was a bit bitter about losing my place in the credits, but because I'd resigned, I wouldn't have been in there anyway. And that was the end of my illustrious Apple career.
Well, I don't know. I mean, a lot of software doesn't ship, doesn't mean that the process wasn't valuable either internally or, you know, for your own career, really.
Yeah. I mean, it was working at Apple was an amazing time. I mean, this was the point, like, I joined at the low point of the company, like, where they were, you know, 30 days away from going bankrupt or whatever the people were saying at the time. And, one of the things I did back then was there was a company stock purchase scheme, and you could do a what was called a buy and hold or a buy and sell on the stock. And it was some kind of elaborate tax thing, which I don't understand. But if you did a buy and hold, you got actual stock. So at the time, the way you do it is you would take your piece of paper and you would put it in one printer paper box that said buy and hold, or one that said buy and sell. And when I went up for my latest stock allocation, I put it in the buy and hold, which was entirely empty. Everybody was just doing a buy and sell to, you know.
That's depressing.
And I thought, what the hell, I'll put it in. So I have a whole lot of stock, which I bought when it was 11, and that was about 4 stock splits ago.
Yeah.
So that was quite nice. I mean, it's still...
So they can have their stinking duck.
Well, the thing was, I, until I actually sell that stock, it doesn't actually count as money. And it's, you know, Apple stock could tank tomorrow.
That's a lot of tanking. But yeah.
Yeah, but it's not a massive amount of money, but it was compared to what it was at the beginning, it's quite right. Nice. But yeah, as I said at the time, the income from Drag Thing was more than the income that I was getting from Apple anyway.
Right. So, that's what I was going to ask you. That did that make it easier to kind of flip from the bird and resign?
Yeah.
In the face of the ultimatum? Yeah.
It made it easier in some ways. I mean, it was still really hard to do because it was like Apple, and you know, working at Apple at what was the, you know, one of the coolest times in the company. Well, so we thought back then anyway. And it was the whole, you know, Phoenix from the ashes moment. So to leave before that really got started was really difficult. And, you know, I'd made lots of friends there, and, you know, I didn't want to leave the company. Mm-hmm. But
financially, at least you had something that.
Yeah. Yeah. Financially, it was an easy decision to make because I could go off. What I did do, moved back to Glasgow, and I'm like about 5 minutes away from my old university. Mm-hmm. And set up my own company, and just to do my own stuff. And that was sort of January 2000, around about then. So it's, you know, over 15 years that I've now been doing it full time for myself.
That's great. That is an achievement in and of itself. Like, it's hard to run a company for 15 years.
Yeah, I mean,
especially in this racket, like software is, you know.
Yeah, I've been pretty lucky. I mean, there's been a lot of sort of. So one of the things that happened after I left, like I wasn't going to go to WWDC or any events for quite a while because I was just thoroughly pissed off with Apple at that point. But I went to one, I think it was in 2001. And at that point there was a, like, Phil Schiller and people would come out and there would be like a meet and greet where they would mix with the developers. And, you know, this was the point where they still had Q&A at the end of sessions and feedback forums and all that sort of stuff. And so I ended up talking to Phil Schiller at this thing. And I explained what it was I did. And I very carefully didn't mention the fact that I'd been an employee a year previously. And I told him about PCalc, and I pressed a business card into his hand and thought nothing of it. A couple of months later, I got contacted by his assistant saying, can Phil have a copy of PCalc? And I was like, sure. So, you know, I sent him a serial number. And sometime later on from that, I was contacted and they said, we'd like to bundle PCalc with the operating system, or with the Mac. And it was with a new product that was coming along. And it turned out to be the Anglepoise white iMacs.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, you get paid a royalty on each copy, but the royalty is like in cents rather than in dollars.
Yeah, I've heard that from a few people. It's the money's not great, but the exposure is really worth
Yeah. People say do it for the exposure, and that's always terrible. But yeah.
Back in those days, at least, upgrade could be a thing, right?
Well, so at the time, we were doing all this negotiation, and we had to hire a very expensive intellectual property lawyer to look at all the contracts and stuff with Apple, just to make sure that we weren't handing over all our rights to them. And the intellectual property lawyer looked at them and said, yeah, it looks okay to me. And it's like, oh, great. That was £2,000 well spent. and it was just getting harder and harder. And there was all these little clauses about how we had to be available to do support for the product at, you know, one business day's notice and things like that. And it wasn't clear what it all meant. So I decided I was going to walk away from the deal. And so I decided the best way to do that was to name a much higher, 10 times higher royalty figure and say that was the minimum that I could do, you know. And I figured at that point they would say, oh, well, never mind. And we could all walk away, and it wasn't like a negative thing. And they said yes immediately. And this told me that, A, I should have asked for even higher because they agreed far too quickly. And so, yeah, PCalc got bundled with all of the white iMacs in that year. I can't remember. It was 2002 or something. And it was 1 million machines in total. And the royalty figure wasn't great, but any number multiplied by a million is pretty good.
Yeah.
So that was, and then a year later, I had an anonymous tip off from somebody that I knew inside Apple that Apple was developing their own calculator for macOS 10 to replace pCalc. And I don't know if that was because Apple just likes to own everything and have the source code to everything. And don't like being dependent on third parties, or whether somebody like my former manager's manager had worked out that who they were sending the royalty checks to. But so I got a year of that, and that was fun. And yeah, and that was the point where I started writing, macOS 10 versions of, I had the macOS 10 version of pCalc, but then I did a macOS 10 version of Drag Thing. And it was basically because I wasn't going to be using the dog, because it wasn't mine. And, when I'd initially taken on working on the dog, I figured if anybody's going to kill off Drag Thing, then it should be me. And I was quite happy to kill my own software, but for somebody else to do it, yeah, I wasn't having that. So I made a version of Drag Thing for macOS 10, which is still running today, just about. And yeah, that was my primary source of income up until the iPhone came along. And at that point, I decided, well, I want to learn how to program the iPhone. So the easiest thing, and the thing that I've done three or four times, is rewrite it for a new device, a new framework. Because it's a small enough project, and all you really need is, some buttons and a display, and you can hook up. The internal logic is portable enough.
Yeah. Have you been using the same math engine since, let's say the first OS 10 versions?
I've been using pretty much the same math engine going back to the Pascal version.
Oh, really? Wow. Okay.
So the Pascal version got converted into C around about, I can't remember, whenever I did the first OS 10 version. And then it got C++ wrapper, and then it got an Objective-C wrapper around it. And there's a lot of the logic in there, and the function names are still the same as the Pascal version. I mean, it's much bigger these days. The analogy that I've used recently is, Star Trek, the motion picture.
Yeah.
So the massive space probe comes from the destructive probe from the other side of the galaxy, and they go,
V'ger. We can get into it. V'ger.
Yeah. Okay. So they go and they find V'ger, and then at the end of the film, spoilers, they discover at the center of this massive probe is the Voyager 6 NASA probe, which has had this huge monolith built around it. And that's basically what the source code to pCalc is like. It's got this little Voyager 6 bit in the middle of it, and then everything is built around it. And it's changed quite a lot. And I've had to rewrite stuff, because there was some of it that I looked at the code, which I'd written 23 years previously when I was, my first application. And I had literally no idea what it did. Mm-hmm. And you say, well, this code doesn't do anything, so I'll take it out. And then, oh, it doesn't work anymore. Well, clearly that code does do something, but what? Who knows? Yeah. So I had to rewrite a lot of that fairly recently so that I could actually maintain it. And that was specifically stuff to do with the operator precedence and the brackets and all that. That code was really hard to read.
Yeah.
So I could port over the Mac code to the iPhone, like the lower level logic. And that was reasonably easy to do. And then I wrote a UIKit app around it. And I think we got the developer kits in like April or something, and the phones were shipping, or not the phones, but the iOS
2.0
stuff was shipping around July, August, that kind of time frame. So it was like 3-4 months to write the first version. And it worked very well, and it started selling very well from the beginning. And it was outselling the Mac version on day one. And I think that was because it's a lot more useful in your hand because it felt like an actual calculator.
Really? Yeah. Plus, I think it was, you know, when first-party apps were first on the phone, everybody wanted to pretty much get everything.
Yeah, and there were only 400 apps in the first day of the store. So to make it on day one was a really big deal. And I think I was the only calculator. So, I mean, the phone
did. Which seems weird. That should have been a gimme. But
yeah, but.
Well, the phone had one, right? So.
Yeah, the phone had one. And. But I've made my living writing software that exists that Apple gives away for free. You know, so application launchers and calculators have never been a market that's not had Apple competing in it.
You Moriarty them is the reverse of a Sherlock.
Yeah. So the first version was selling really well, and I just started putting my time into that because it was clear, you know, the income from DragThing was pretty good in the early days of Mac OS X, but eventually the power users all moved over to using, you know, things like LaunchBar and all the typing based shortcut things, and everybody else just used the dock because it was there. But you know, it had been good for a long time but it was tailing off, and the sales of Peacock were just really good. Mm-hmm. And I remember sitting in a pub. It was like the first day that we got sales figures, and I was sitting in a pub with a bunch of other Scottish developers, and you know, everybody was sort of nervously checking their sales figures. And I saw the first day or a couple of days. And then you take that figure and you multiply it by 365 and you think, you know, I'm buying a yacht. This is, you know, this is amazing. But of course it doesn't work like that. And you just get a big spike in the first couple of days.
Yeah. What were you selling it for at the time?
$10, same as I am today. I've like done 8 years at pretty much the same price.
Yeah.
And
that's
been you could call it, good business strategy, or you could call it stubbornness.
Well, that wasn't unusual back then, right? Like Super Monkey Ball was $10. I think Instapaper was $10. Twitterific.
Yeah. I mean, when I started, Peacock on the Mac was at that point $20. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I could see that everybody was trying to work out how they were going to price their iPhone apps at that time. And $10 seemed like the natural point for it, and that it wasn't as full featured as the Mac version was at that point. $10 seemed right. And then gradually, you know, prices started to erode, but I tried some experiments and I cut the price by half at one point. I made it $5 and sales went up, and they went up initially slightly more than twice, but then they settled back down to pretty much the same level. And it's like, well, people are going to buy a fixed amount of this, if it's $5 or $10, it makes sense to price it at $10.
Yeah.
So that I actually can have a sustainable living and I can do this full time. So that was $10, and most of my development effort started going into the iOS version. And after, you know, 3-4 years, the iOS version was actually more fully featured than the Mac version was. And the Mac version was still written with, at that point, it was using C++ and HI Toolbox Carbon stuff. Mm-hmm. And I had all these different source bases, and it was getting quite hard to manage. And one of the things I did a couple of years ago was I ported the iOS version back to the Macintosh. To Cocoa, and it was actually my first desktop Cocoa app. I'd written, you know, I'd done 4 or 5 years of Cocoa Touch before I'd actually touched AppKit on the desktop.
Oh, that's interesting, because you've been around for so long. I figured you would have
mucked
around with AppKit a bit, you know.
It was basically because I was, when the next guys came in at Apple, there was very much a culture war that went on internally in Apple. And I was very much on the side of the traditional Mac OS old guard, and these interlopers coming in with their object-oriented frameworks and all this. And so I was just being a bit stubborn. And it was what I knew as well. Right. But,
and, you know, HI Toolbox is pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, it was good. But it was, if especially if you're using something like PowerPlant with it, right. You know, writing bare to the frameworks was still a bit of a hassle.
But it was, just for the listeners, it was kind of like an object-oriented C, right? Like it, I think Core Foundation, but with UI.
Yeah, yeah.
Elements, basically, yeah.
And so when I did the rewrite into Cocoa, it was actually, I was forced to admit that it was actually quite good. It wasn't as good as Cocoa Touch was, which, you know, I'd used the more modern version of it first. So coming back to AppKit, it was like a step backwards. And there was like 13 ways to do everything. And, you know, 7 of them didn't work. And
it's been around for 20 plus years, right? So
exactly. Yeah. And Cocoa Touch was doing a lot less at the time. But it was interesting, and it was a good learning experience to get stuff up on the Mac. And now,
were you ever tempted to sort of, some people have backported from iOS to the Mac, kind of just drag UIKit with them and sort of re-implement UIKit. Was that ever?
No, because the kind of things that I, you know, if you had a lot of, UI navbar type stuff where you're tunneling in and tunneling out, that kind of UI isn't really appropriate on the Mac. It's not really. And for a lot of stuff I was using custom views anyway, so custom UI views. So to turn that into a custom NS view, that wasn't a huge amount because I was doing all the drawing myself for everything anyway.
Yeah, you get the draw rect and you get some state and you do your thing.
Yeah. So a lot of the state, it wasn't just like purely low level stuff that came across. I could bring up quite a lot. I mean, one of the, getting it across and writing a proper Mac app around it was my goal. But to use as much as I could, like there's code for like laying out buttons, for drawing buttons, for all the logic of things, the conversions. So, you know, I've got a routine which you can just say, give me a list of all the units for this particular category and then perform a conversion from this to this. Right. All that stuff came over, and it's very easy to wire a UI up to that. Like the drawing code, for example, came from DragThing. Like all the custom theme engine that I wrote in DragThing, I ported that to the phone when I did the first iOS version. So that's made the port. It went from Mac to the phone and back to the Mac.
Nice.
And when it came back to the Mac, I came back with all the nice Retina support and stuff that I'd written since then. I mean that was 2 years ago or something that I did the Mac peek out version 4 on the Mac.
Mm-hmm.
And since that point, I've had a very portable core engine that has all the necessary stuff that I can pull onto any new platform that appears pretty easily. As you will have seen over the last year.
Yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, that was a smart move. I think regardless of, I don't know how much the Mac contributes to your revenue right now, but certainly having a portable base has paid off in spades, I think.
Yeah. I mean, the Mac is probably about 20%, I would say. It's iOS 80%, Mac 20% in terms of revenue. They're both
$10. That's pretty good. I think I would have guessed less if I had to.
I mean, the Mac, I mean, there was a million people had a copy of pCalc on their Mac a long time ago. And I still get email from those people saying, you know, I'm running version 2.1.3 or whatever, you know, do I get a free upgrade to the latest version? And I'm like, well, you do realize that's 16 years old at this point.
So with the portable base, you've gone to, good move, because Apple has been plopping out platforms left and right for the past couple of years. We've got the watch, we've got the TV, we've got iPads of various sizes.
Yeah. I mean, the iPad was really just an extension of the existing app. And I've never really had much distinction. I mean, there's like you get extra toolbar and extra things happen if you're on an iPad. But it was actually reasonably lucky, because when split screen multitasking happened.
Right. Yeah.
You need to have a universal app that can be both a phone app and an iPad app really in this at the same time. So that was, very lucky that I did it that way because it meant supporting a split screen was fairly easy.
Yeah. I don't know if it's luck, whatever, foresight.
Yeah.
It's not like you knew what was going to happen.
The harder you work, the luckier you are.
Yeah.
I mean, you set yourself up for success basically.
Yeah, but I do know that I've been lucky at a lot of stages of my career and I've been at exactly the right place at the right time. I think there is a certain amount of hard work as well, but, you know, I don't want to sit here saying, you know, well, I foresaw everything that was going to happen.
Oh, yeah, no, I don't mean that, but I mean, adopting size classes becomes easier when you've already kind of struggled with it internally to do an iPad and a phone version.
Yeah,
I mean, what that means to be on different size.
Well, there was rumors around the iOS 8 timeframe that there was going to be split screen in one of the iOS 8 revisions. So I'd worked on getting split screen stuff basically working for iOS 8 and then it didn't ship. So when it came out in iOS 9, it was actually, you know, I just had to basically test it and it was all working, which was good. And then, yeah, the watch came along. And that was a very interesting experience because so where I started with all this is I'm a UI guy. I don't actually like calculators. You know, I'm not, I don't have this big thing about calculators, but I love creating user interfaces. And that was, as I said, was my favorite course at university was we would take apart some element of the classic Macintosh, like an open save dialog. And sort of look at why it was the way it was and, you know, all the user testing and that side of things I really enjoyed. So, you know, when the watch comes along, it's a challenge. You know, I can get my code on it easily, but can I come up with something that's usable? And, you know, is it something that people want to use? I didn't know at the time, you know, would it even be possible to do something? And I've heard that people do use it, you know, I think it was Federico was saying that he would use it when he was out grocery shopping and things like that. But I do get
anyone who ever had a Casio calculator watch and was just nostalgic for it.
Strangely enough, I did have a Casio calculator watch. So yeah, there was something of that. And again, I wasn't actually going to have something running for day one of the watch. And I decided, no, I'm not going to do it because, you know, there's going to be a native SDK at some point in the future. And this is too limited the way it's, you know, every time you push a button, it's got to communicate over Bluetooth or whatever with the phone and then back again. And there's just going to be too much latency and so on.
It's a cute idea, but in practice, a little bit iffy.
Yeah. So, and then the Calcbot guys shipped one on day one. And I was like, damn it. you know, I would say we have a friendly rivalry between us. I think we're in different areas of the market anyway. So it's not like we're stealing sales from each other, but they had a calculator watch on day one. And it was like, yeah, everybody got all the press. And I was like, oh, damn. Oh, okay. Well, I need to do one. So, and I got my watch at the time and, you know, I'd played around with things and I was like, yeah, actually, I think I can get something to work. And I found some optimizations that got the latency down for the taps. So I got something shipped. I think it was about a month later, after the watch had come out. And yeah, I was quite happy with it. And for the limitations of WatchKit at the time. And, subsequently that's WatchKit 2. And the main thing that gets me is the launch time. And I have yet to work out how to get the launch time down on a watchOS app. You know, even basic Hello World type apps still seem to take, you know, 5-6 seconds.
Wait for future hardware, James.
Yeah, future hardware, but what's it doing? So, you know, I want to get that better because now with the, Touch ID being so fast on the phone, it's literally quicker to get out my phone and instantly unlock it and do something in pCalc on that. You know,
actually, this raises a really interesting, and I wanted to ask you about this. I feel bad saying this. I no longer use pCalc on my phone because you made an extensibility widget. And it is just so fast for me to pull down Notification Center and do 90% of the things I would do in pCalc right there. And I don't even have to launch your app anymore. I feel terrible about it, but it is just so convenient.
Well, you know, so long as you're using my code somewhere, I don't care which platform or which bit of the OS you're doing it in. You've paid your money. Well, no, I mean, that's not true, because you do actually get the widget in the free version as well. pCalc Lite is a whole other story of stuff, and we won't get into patent lawsuits and the joys of that. But that's another thing. Like, you know, the widgets I could do fairly easily because I had this portable code, and it's a case of plug in the portable code. All you need is some buttons, display, and you can get quite advanced functionality, fairly quickly up and running.
Can we lightly talk about the existential crisis in widgets that you caused by shipping that?
Yeah.
So my understanding is that when this was originally proposed, they really didn't think that with the memory constraints and everything like that, you could fit an actual app into there. So there were loose guidelines that it had to be for incredibly light, incredibly brief interactions. And then apparently some engineer from fucking Scotland put an entire calculator in there that no one was expecting, and it caused a little bit of a kerfuffle at the time, but resulted in, I think, an expansion of what everyone thought widgets could do.
Yeah, I mean, so what happened there was, I think it was at the same event they had they showed the notification center in, was it Yosemite, that had a calculator widget in it. And I thought, well, you know, if it's good enough for Notification Center on the Mac, surely they're going to do the same thing on iOS. And they hadn't.
Well, they didn't have the resources that they gave themselves in Yosemite.
And so I thought, well, you know, I think I can do this, you know, and there's nothing that specifically says I can't do it. And, there were very, you know, you had to fit in quite small memory. Like you could run in 10 megabytes or something. And you had to start within a certain amount of time. And so it was very resource constrained. But you know, I'd got pCalc running on the original iPhone and indeed on the Mac Classic. So it was doable. I knew that. So I did it and it shipped. And before that, I'd had, engineers within Apple had been running it, and you know, marketing people within Apple had been running it. It was a known thing, and it shipped, and it got featured quite heavily on the store, you know, under Notification Center and, you know, apps for iOS 8 and all this. And I was very pleased with that, and it did very well in terms of sales. I think it was like then there was Yosemite shipped. So I was working away on the Yosemite version, which had its own Notification Center widget as well. And I was just about to ship that when I got contacted. Whenever App Review contacts you, yeah, you know something bad has happened. And I had an email that said, "We're going to schedule a call with you." And I'm like,
I hate this characterization, but people always make it sound like that black car pulls up as you're leaving the bar and the window rolls down and people say, "Get in."
Yeah, there's a certain amount of that. And I got phoned up and they said, you know, we've changed our mind. And, you know, it has been decided higher up that this is not the kind of thing that we want. And, you know, there's the line about, you know, widgets are not allowed to perform calculations or some such, I'd worked quite hard on that and I was pretty annoyed. And so I tweeted a couple of things and I went out and I went to a friend's book launch and I was just aware at some point that my wrist was just constantly vibrating. And at this point it was my Pebble, I think it was. And, you know, I realized something was going on. And by the time I got back in, there was, you know, there were stories all over the internet. And there's that point where something goes viral, especially something where you're basically being critical of Apple, and all you can think of is like, you know, oh fuck, I have burnt all my bridges with Apple here, and this is going to go very badly. And you know, it was great that I was getting support from people, and people were saying that this was ridiculous and Apple was being draconian and all this. But literally all I could think of was, you know, I have, you know, this is the end of my promising developer career, and Apple are going to make my life quite difficult. And the thing is, Apple is not one big monolithic entity. And that's what people forget, is that, you know, you get people in engineering, you know, create an API and they might have some idea of what they want. And there's people in marketing who have some idea what they want. And there's people in, you know, app review. And then there's all these different organizations, and there's not like one consensus. And so, you know, when I talked to this person, I said, you know, I want to appeal this decision because, you know, this, I think this is ridiculous. And, they said, well, you know, I can do that, but I want to set your expectations right now that, you know, this decision is not going to change. This was made high up. And I'm like, okay. And, you know, so that was why I then went off and I tweeted these things. And it wasn't because I was trying to get, you know, the internet to blow up or anything. It was just a bit of venting because I'd spent a lot of time on this and it looked like it was all, I was going to have to rip it all out. And that was the message that I got was, you know, take the stuff out in the next couple of weeks or the next revision of your app. Otherwise, you know, it will get pulled from the store. And then there was such an outpouring and it made sites that were outside the sort of tech sphere. Still tech sites, but, you know, it made it to places like The Guardian and all that. And then weird things started happening over the next couple of days. And somebody contacted me from, I think it was The Guardian or the BBC, and they said, we've heard that Apple have changed their mind on this. And I'm like, well, I've heard nothing at all. You know, I'd love to believe this, but this seems strange that, and then it became clear that Apple was briefing the press that they had changed their mind. And, you know, this had been a case that they hadn't, anticipated, but, you know, having seen it, they were now prepared to allow it and, you know, broaden the kind of apps that were allowed. But at this point, I'd still heard nothing at all. I think it was like a day or two later. I can't remember. There'd been stories in the press where it was clear that Apple PR had spoken to these people and given them a story. And
well, there's far fewer layers to go from PR to journalist than there is to go through the app, like through the marketing org or developer relations orgs.
And these things take a while, but it was a very strange experience to, you know, be reading about yourself in the press and be reading about these decisions being changed and still not actually officially having heard anything of the like. And eventually I got a call from the same person at AppReview who basically, it was a, you know, few minute call saying, yeah, we've changed our mind. It's fine. You don't need to do anything. It's all okay. And it was just a roller coaster that, I mean, from the first email to the last phone call, it was about 2 weeks or something. And it was 2 weeks of up and down and, you know, the exhilaration of everybody in the press reporting this and then the terror that everybody in the press was reporting this. And then it eventually went through. And the interesting thing was the publicity that I got from all that of being, you know, making it out to sites outside the normal, you know, not
the biz, you know, pubs. You made it into the biz pubs.
Yes. And, making it out into things like The Guardian and The Telegraph and newspapers. Was sales of Peek Out went through the roof and they basically doubled. I mean, there was a big spike and then they doubled and they stayed doubled for the next year. And, you know, I think it was a certain amount of publicity and just exposure, to use that word again. I think halfway through week one, or when it was all going wrong, I bought myself an Xbox because that was like, right, I'm just going to buy this and I'm going to play Tomb Raider and I'm just going to disconnect from the world for a bit. And then when sales had spiked because of all this coverage, and it was really nice to have like the community come behind me, because I think there was a certain amount that people realized that, there was a lot more focus of app review on widgets and what could and couldn't be done. And there was things like there was a launcher widget, and eventually there was a string of high profile rejections or post approval rejections, which I think all eventually got turned over again.
Well, it was something new, and people, like you said, internally had different ideas of what they thought would be a good and bad experience. And those things are always hotly debated.
Yeah, and you could hear the debate inside Apple, and I got, you know, people privately inside Apple messaged me saying, this is absolutely ridiculous, yeah. You know, and, you know, you've set several internal mailing lists on fire, which apparently I do on with some regularity. But it was nice to have people back me, and it was nice to be able to sort of maybe open the door slightly wider for other stuff. But I've been the poster child for a number of things over the years, and it makes me increasingly wary when it happens.
But you're never a jerk about it. You're never like, oh, this whole thing is broken and terrible and you all suck, and you've stated a problem. And even though like you might be worried that some people at Apple will be upset that you're stating it, there are other people in there who have the same opinion that you do, and that sort of maybe fuels or helps them with getting that agenda pushed forward.
Well, I mean, I don't know if this is weird, but, you know, Apple is still family in some way. You know, I work there and, you know, for my entire professional career, I've done things in and around Apple, and, you know, bits of Apple can be a bit of a jerk occasionally and other bits aren't. And, you know, for every, one person who contacts you saying this, you get some internal engineer or higher up who says, you know, really like your stuff, and we're working to try and change whatever it is.
Well, like you said at the beginning, and I don't know how aware people are of this, but you have the engineers in Craig Federighi's organization who makes all these APIs and these frameworks, and when they say we can't wait to see what you do with it, they're sincere about that. They want to see cool stuff. And then you have App Review and the entire developer relations org, and they're slammed when a new product is coming out. So all they do is make sure that it really works and put it out. And then once the store gets it, as long as it's approved, they can feature it. And they're a business. They want to do whatever they can to make the App Store successful. So they pick stuff that they think is great for the platform and they feature it. And then when everything calms down and people have a second to breathe, they look at it and they go, this is not quite what we had in mind. How did this get through? And that's when all this sort of post acceptance rejection stuff happens.
And I mean, that's just one factor of having a vast organization with, you know, tens of thousands of employees in it. Not everybody can be of the one mind. And yeah, I mean, I try not to be a jerk about anything because, well, A, Apple is much bigger than me and I rely on them for my entire income stream. But B, you know, it's not generally the fault of anyone. And just saying, you know, Apple is terrible, you know, it still feels like attacking, you know, my old boss kind of thing. There was some trepidation, like with the Apple TV. So that's the most recent port of Peacock and possibly the most contentious. Contentious in I've heard people Tapbot's Paul was commenting on it a few weeks ago.
Yeah. I love the idea. I mean, it's a funny one, but I love it. I love that it's there. I think that it speaks to your eagerness to adopt, you know, things like the extension widget that we just talked about, the watch and being on the TV. You're kind of all in on Apple, which is kind of what you just finished saying, but But
yeah, I mean, the reason I did it is a number of reasons. You know, the one thing with the watch was I wasn't sure if people would use Peacock on the watch. And I hear from people that do, that genuinely like it. And part of my ethos is, you know, it's Peacock everywhere. You know, put it on any device that can run it. And if people find it useful, that's great. If people don't find it useful, you know, maybe they'll find it useful on some other, you know, on their phone or on their iPad or on their Mac or whatever. And it doesn't hurt to have right. it on a device. But the thing that I wanted to do was it's a new platform. It's a new Apple thing. I want to be there on day one. But I also want to learn the platform, and it was a case of, well, I want to learn, tvOS, see what it's like, see how close it is to iOS, which is very close.
Focus engine's interesting.
Yeah. And so it was playing with the Focus engine, and that was my, so the first version of Peacock for the Apple TV, took me 4 days from beginning to end. And on the fifth day, I made the icon. And
biblical.
I'm not going to make any comment of, like John Lennon. But so it was a quick experiment to learn the platform and to, in a way, maybe, you know, get something up there that's a bit different. And, you know, it's that idea of keeping the door slightly wider for other things to follow. And I wasn't sure if it was going to be approved at all. And I figured, worst case, I've spent 4 or 5 days on this and I make something that's interesting. And the reason, the legitimate reason for having it is that I heard that there were a lot of Apple TVs in classrooms and in other education settings and things. And I thought, yeah, that, you know, maybe there's a case to have it. And then once I'd done it and I got the first version up and it was approved, I decided that the input on it is on using the Apple remote. It's, you know, you've got a grid, so it's not as bad as the standard Apple keyboard where you're sort of flipping from one side to the other, but you're still, you know, you have to sort of navigate around each button. And that was a bit painful. And I was sort of playing around with it and I thought, you know, what would be really good was if I added game controller support to this calculator. And
it's just, of course.
It's just one of those ideas. And I was like, well, I was thinking about getting one of the MFI game controllers anyway, you know, because I like playing games. And I thought, well, if I get it this way, this is clearly a business expense because I'm using this for development purposes. So the business will buy me a game controller.
On the tax form, it says for maths.
Yes. Actually, I have put it in the release notes for the most recent update. It does say that, you know, now you can be justified in buying that game controller because it's for business. But, you know, what I like is a user interface thing to play with. And I was playing around with these sort of circular menus using the thumbsticks and the triggers and stuff. And I thought, this is interesting. This is nice. And it's fun. And I spent a lot of time while I was doing it thinking, I should really write a game. I want to write a game. And I've said this for the entirety of my development career. And I know there's virtually no money in games and it's a bad idea to put all your time and effort into doing a game, but I've always wanted to write one. But adding game controller support and having the little game controller icon appear in the App Store next to Peacock, it's slightly pushing the boundaries. It's like, I was thinking, am I going to get approved for this? You know, is somebody going to say, you know, calculators cannot use game controllers somewhere in App Review? I mean, it's an entirely legitimate concern. I mean, I've had this a number of times that.
Yeah, you know, it's just, I'm laughing because it's a shame that you're gun shy and it's rational to be so.
I'm gun shy, but I do it anyway. Yeah. Partially, you know, there's something in the back of my brain that says, well, you know, after what happened last time with the widgets, somebody in App Review is probably not going to reject me on this because, yeah, you know, there might be a, you know, there might be some feedback on that.
Yeah. I would also add that their inability to sort of decide what is good for the extension or not, or whether or not you can use a game controller for your calculator or not, and kind of get their acts together on that. That's the downside. The flip side is I think that they would be equally disorganized in terms of being vindictive.
No, I mean, I don't think
you have anything to worry about, right? Like,
I don't think there's like some, well, I am probably on some lists at Apple, but you know, I don't think I'm on like an app review list where, you know, they look at me and go, oh no, we know him. He's a known troublemaker.
Yeah. Like that thing about worrying about your career is like, I don't think that like people.
No, there's not. I think that's just the sort of the irrational part of your brain that kicks in when you're seeing like newspapers discuss things about you and you're on like every other podcast, you know, it's a fear response. It's not.
I would have the exact same response. I just don't think they're organized enough to be. to make it stick.
You know, Steve Jobs, you know, at his prime, might have taken a grudge against somebody, but I don't. You know, I would like to think it wasn't me. So the TV thing, it's an experiment. And I've actually been considering, I was sitting the other day and I was thinking, I wonder if I could use the gyroscope stuff in the standard remote and do a kind of Wii remote like pointer.
Yeah.
You know how the interface worked on the Wii?
And yeah. PS4 has one like that that's based just off the gyroscope.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you tilt it left or right to move the cursor left or right.
Yeah, I've seen that kind of thing, and I was thinking, yeah, that's probably doable. So, you know, that might be the next thing I do just for a bit of fun, is just to play with a, you know, a third way of interacting. Just, you know, that's what I like. I like playing with user interfaces, and I like not necessarily making the thing that's obvious, but, you know, making something that is fun. And I try and put...
That's a great life mission.
And I try and put a bit of personality into my apps. You know, it's not all just sort of, you know, there's little Easter eggs and there's little things like the names of the themes and stuff like that. And I try and put a bit of personality into it. And that seems to be working. And sales, you know, sales of the TV app are not going to buy me that yacht. I mean, the App Store, the discoverability, I think, is, as far as I know, is there's still no utilities category. So if you want to find Peacock, you need to type it in by name if it's not featured on the front page.
And you can't get you can't hit a link.
You can't hit links. Yeah. So, you know, it's very hard to promote it. And it was featured. I imagine it's not anymore, but it was featured for a week. And that, you know, they got reasonable sales for it. And it got up to something like 30-something in the top overall charts, and I could see the amount of money that I was making at 30 in the top overall charts. And you know, there wasn't a vast amount of money for the first few weeks there, and I think it was a similar number of apps. It was like 400 apps roughly when it launched, about the same as the iPhone.
Yeah, they didn't put up any categories or anything that they couldn't actually fill with apps.
Yeah, and you know, Peacock was the number one utility because people were like, Steve Troughton Smith, known troublemaker, he was scraping some of the back end stuff and pulling charts out because they had all the data there and it was available via whatever APIs they had. And I could see that, you know, Peacock was the number one utility, but, you know, there were only about 10 of them. I consider it a success because, you know, it didn't pay for itself in terms of development time yet. You know, because I've put 2 weeks of development into it, and I don't have exact figures on me how much I made, but I know it's not 2 weeks worth of development time. But it was fun to do, and it gave me something interesting to play with on the Apple TV. And some people are finding it useful. So, you know, you can't really say more than that.
Well, I mean, and also every sale is a sale that you wouldn't have had.
Yeah, I mean, there's the universal purchase stuff where you can associate a TV app with an iOS app, and you buy one and you get the other. And I couldn't do that because I have Peacock Lite, which you can upgrade through in-app purchase to the you know, piecemeal up to the full functionality of pCalc. And I wouldn't do that again because that was a bit of an experiment in in-app purchasing and pricing. And to be honest, it's like 10% of revenue comes from Lite. Most of it comes from people just buying the full versions outright. But because I have that free version, I couldn't associate, for one, you could only associate the TV app with one app.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I would have to have, you know, pCalc TV Lite as well as a separate thing.
It's kind of confusing the way they term it because people are used to universal apps, which is one binary that downloads to multiple devices. And this isn't that. These are two separate binaries that are put together to make a universal purchase. So when you buy one of them, the other one is put in the purchased list on the Apple TV.
Yeah, yeah. So because pCalc was free, if I bundled a version of it with pCalc Lite, that would also immediately be free. So basically, I'd be giving it away. And I didn't really want to give it away, but there wasn't a good way to communicate between the two. And eventually, after looking into all of these things, I figured I'll just make it a completely standalone thing and make it $2. Because it's an experiment, it doesn't have the full functionality of pCalc on the phone. And I'm going to add stuff to it over time that's useful. But, you know, make it $2. So it's not free. So I might make some money from it. And it's not an outrageous price that people are going to say no to. You hope anyway. And yeah, it's done well. It's a little standalone thing. And if people want it, they can get it. And if they don't, they don't have to buy it. But, you know, hopefully they buy one of the other ones.
Well, I'm looking forward to the next platform that comes out so you can
peek in the dashboard.
Yeah, peek out on the Apple helicopter or something.
The hot tub is my...
I think, you know, using a calculator while driving a car is probably in contravention of, you know, California driving laws or whatever.
So how are we supposed to figure out what miles are, James?
Well, I do have all the speed and distance conversions in there. So, you know, who knows? If Apple keep releasing platforms that are effectively based on iOS, I'm going to keep porting pCalc to it, you know, and regardless of what people want or expect.
I have to also add that you were one of the first developers who I ever got a press release from when I started working at iMore. And to this day, you remain one of the most delightful press release writers. And I always look forward to receiving those when you have a new version or a new product.
Well, sometimes, you know, because especially with iOS, I imagine that you are inundated with dozens, if not hundreds of press releases in a daily basis. And if you can do something that is stands out in any way or makes them laugh or like with the TV thing, I send out a press release and Sue from Macworld, she retweeted it and
Susie Oakes.
Yes, Susie Oakes. She retweeted a little bit of it, which, you know, got 100-something-odd retweets, and that got some publicity as well. And it's just, yeah, if you can make people laugh with a press release. I do feel pressure sometimes. You know. you're trying to, if you're sitting there and you're trying to write a press release and you've added sort of esoteric math things to it, and you know that most of the people reading it are not particularly going to care about that. And it's hard to sort of... make it enthusiastic sounding. You know, if you can put something in that's funny, then you know, people might mention it. And that's the thing is that the hardest part of app development is the marketing. I find writing apps easy, pretty much. I mean, it's not like easy, but compared to actually trying to get people to talk about it or to get coverage or to get featured on the App Store and that kind of thing, that's the hard part. That's the business side. And, you know, being active on Twitter and sort of trying to be more part of the community in general, I think helps a lot in getting coverage and getting noticed and things like that. And I think that helps a lot in sales.
Yeah, you want people to use your stuff.
And
not having marketing is like not having design.
Yeah. And it's nice that, you know, if even if there's a review of another calculator, it's pretty certain that that review is going to mention pCalc in it at some point. And
right. It's a great position to be in, right?
Yeah, and I'm, you know, I keep using the word luck, but it is luck, and it's luck, and the fact that I've been around for 23 years,
right?
You know, get rid of you.
Yeah, and I mean, like I said, there was a million iMacs got pCalc on them, so there was a lot of those people know pCalc, and they you know they used it, 15 years ago, and are still using it or whatever. So, you know, because I've been around for a long time, it's a great help as well.
And you're already picturing the virtual reality version in your head now, aren't you?
Well, you say that, but I have actually thought about that. You know, what could you do? I wish Apple would do a VR headset, you know, a proper, Oculus Rift style device. And it would be nice if it was running iOS. And yes, I would make a calculator that floated in the air in front of you and you sort of do a whole Minority Report style, user interface with it. Yes, I'd love to do that.
No pressure.
So where can people find your stuff?
Well, if you go to pCalc.com, you will find all the pCalc related links, except for the Apple TV, of course. if you go to tla.systems, that's the sort of parent website for my company. You can find me on Twitter at James Thompson, but Thompson without a P.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I know. You can't spell it correctly.
I know.
And you've known me for what, like 8 years or something?
Yeah. Keep trying.
But yeah, Gruber spelled it wrong the other day as well. He apologized. Like, I didn't correct him and he apologized. So that was something. But it's a constant fight.
I feel like at this point, it's your job to change it.
Well, if you speak to anyone who's called Thompson and it's Thompson without a P, you can have this shared moment with them. Like, I was in the pharmacy the other day and the guy behind the counter, and we had this moment of, yes, I know, because we have spent our lives correcting the spelling.
I just figured you only had one P and you put it in the calc name, so you just couldn't.
Well,
left.
So the P in pCalc stood for programmer, or programmer's calculator, but the programmer was me. And that was really where the name came from.
The last mystery is solved.
Nice. Well, there's still the mystery of 42. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, the reason that was there, if you don't mind another anecdote after we've done the summing up, the reason it was there was Douglas Adams of Hitchhiker's Guide fame was a beta tester and user of DragThing. And I added a number of things to DragThing for him. Mm-hmm. Like Frontier support, the Frontier scripting stuff. I did that specifically for Douglas Adams. And we had, you know, various emails back and forward. And you know, he was always very, you know, he had ideas for things and he would have comments and stuff. And we talked about, you know, the G4 Cube when it came out. And I met him once at WWDC because they had all the what was the name of the – they had the group of all the sort of luminaries – for Apple. Apple Masters, I think it was.
I think that was it, yeah.
Yeah. And he was one of them. And he was at WWDC, and I came up to him and, you know, shook his hand. And, like, I'm not a particularly tall person, and Douglas Adams is a particularly tall person. And so I shook his hand, and, you know, he remembered who I was and talked to him, whatever. And we'd had this conversation, and I was going through to WWDC, like, a month or two later. And, you know, I was going to, you know, say hello to him then and, you know, hope to see him kind of thing. And there was the announcement that he died. And this was, I think it was just before like the original iPod came out and all this stuff. And that was like, in a weird way, it was a sort of precursor to how I felt when Steve Jobs died, because this was a guy who I like immensely respected. And, you know, I didn't have that many personal interactions with Steve Jobs, but, you know, I talked to Douglas Adams, and it was really shocking and it hit me. And I'd always had the 42, which was, of course, the ultimate answer for life, the universe and everything from the books. And I'd had that on the icon because I needed to put a number on the icon of when it was a little picture of a calculator. And I picked 42 because that's what you do. And subsequent to then, I've never taken it off because, I decided, you know, it, in some ways it's a little tribute. And there was, there was an Easter egg on quite a few of the versions of pCalc that if you put 42 into every memory and you clicked the screen, it would say, don't panic, and various Hitchhiker references. And I kept a lot of that stuff in because, you know, it's a tiny tribute to Douglas Adams, but you know, he was somebody that I looked up to, and it was very sad when he died. So that is the true mystery of the 42.
That's great. And fitting because he was such a Mac fan. And
yeah,
that's great.
I think he bought the first Mac in the UK, and I think Stephen Fry bought the second one.
It's a good lineup.
Yeah.
Great. Twitter, anything you want to say how people can interact with you?
Yeah. So yeah, follow me, James Thompson without P on Twitter. I'm usually reading and responding to anything and searching Twitter for any mention of the word pCalc. and yeah, talk to me there. That's the best way.
Great. Thanks so much, James. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, I see we're at 2 hours and I don't quite see how it can be 2 hours, but yeah.
Oh, you're an interesting fella.
Well, I didn't even tell you all the stories about Steve Wozniak, but we'll do that next time.
We'll get you back.
Say something for the sequel.
Yeah. A pleasure.
You too. Cool. Thanks a lot, James. Really appreciate that.